Hello and welcome to Real Geeks. I am Crash and Burn, and with me as always is Mike Montgomery.
And this week it's the movie that, and you wouldn't think that this would be the movie that did it, but this is the movie that I probably nearly died for several times as a child.
Okay, that's gonna be an interesting story to get into, because yeah, I can see how that could happen. I can see how that can definitely happen, especially in the early the 80s and early 90s. Kids used to play rough, but oh my, I hope gunpowder was involved.
Tragically no, but as long as we're gonna bring guns into this, and considering what the movie is, yeah, guns are going to be brought into this, goddammit.
This is not a pro-gun movie. This is not an anti-gun movie. This movie doesn't even know that there's a debate. This is the quintessential, stereotypical, cliche action film. They do not get no more action filmier than this. This is your base. Anything else that makes an action film, especially a classic, is something that has been added to this film. This isn't even the Big Mac of action films. This is like the hamburger of films. This is the original concept of what if I steamed hams and fed them to my boss? there's no other way to say it. This is Commando!
They hunted him down.
You know, Colonel, we went through a lot of trouble to find you.
They murdered his friends. And they took the only thing he would kill for.
If he wants your kid back, then you gotta cooperate. Right?
Wrong.
Now, somewhere, somehow, someone's gonna pay.
Do you think that he is going to give us any problems?
He'll do exactly as he's told.
Hasta luego, fellas.
You're a funny guy, Sally. That's why I'm going to kill you last.
Are you going to tell me what's going on or what?
No. Don't disturb my friend. He's dead tired. What are you doing?
Helping you get her back.
Remember, Sally, when I promised to kill you last?
That's right, Major. You did.
I lied.
If it's a mission no man can survive, he's the man for the job. Arnold Schwarzenegger, Commando.
Let's party.
So, this was on my list. Now, this, of course, came out in 1985. Mm-hmm. But as far as where it comes into my life, we jump ahead to about, it was somewhere around 1987, 1988. And I first discovered this one was on home video. Like, I've never had the pleasure of seeing this beautiful schlock in a theater. But I would, this, when I was like I was about 7, 8 years old, and I was allowed to go to the video store to rent movies by myself. Mm-hmm. This was the one that I would go to rent over and over and over. but in the suburb of St. Vitale in Winnipeg, where I lived, to get to the video store, I had to walk along a certain segment of St. Mary's Road where there are no sidewalks. Not only are there no sidewalks, where you had to walk was the shoulder of the road that was about 2 feet wide.
Incredible.
Now, okay, now see, this gets better because those of you, if you don't live in Winnipeg, you are still familiar with St. Mary's Road, but you know it by a different name. The Trans-Canada Highway.
Mm-hmm.
So every time I go to rent this movie, I am walking with, like, to my left, 6 inches to my left, cars, buses, pickup trucks, tractor trailers, any of whom, one slight accidental swerve to the right, and I am roadkill.
It was the 80s. This was considered safe because you're not walking in the road.
Exactly. Not just safe, but more convenient. Because
more convenient.
Because the loop that I would have had to take in to get to an actual sidewalk would have, I think, added at least 10, maybe 15 minutes to the walk.
I've only been to Winnipeg a few times, but I am fundamentally of the belief that it was designed to kill its own citizens.
Oh, it is Winnipeg especially. Yeah, no, you are not wrong. But, and also another note just to add to that, this movie, now, you know how people will often claim, and by people, I mean paid off by the NRA.
Yeah.
We'll claim that, you know, no, it's not guns that are the problem. It's the violent movies and so forth. I'm sorry. Commando is the reason that I am the poster child for why that argument is utter bullshit.
You should have definitely slaughtered like a Central to South American would-be dictatorship by now. Like, just gone through them like tissue paper.
Oh, yeah, no, yeah, like by this logic, I at 43 years old, should have been the center of at least 4 mass shooting incidents by now.
All of which end with you just, like, giving up, walking out, and some fucking military official coming up and being like, no, nah, it's cool. Don't worry about it. No, it's cool. It's cool. Let him go. Okay. All right. Bye. Did he just steal a weapons van? Yeah, it's cool. No. He's going to the next thing. Don't worry about it. It's cool. The collateral damage in this. Okay, cool. All right. So that makes sense. Yes. Yeah, so that sounds like you, put a lot on the line to watch this film. You may not have thought of it that way as a child, but hey, you know.
I didn't know any goddamn better.
Right? My first brush with this movie was probably, yeah, when, like, some older kid rented it. And yeah. you're sitting there and watching it, and it's like, oh, okay. Yeah, we're going full throttle. This movie is definitely, for a good 15 to 20 years, this is the movie that I suspect my mom immediately thought of whenever she heard the word Arnold Schwarzenegger. Because this this is fundamentally what an Arnold Schwarzenegger 80s action film is. It's when I said earlier, it's the stereotype, it's the cliche, it literally is. This is smarter than most people give it credit for, because let's face it, the vast majority of Arnold lines in it are one-liners. Like, his entire dialogue is one-liners, but that's where so many of the presumptions and jokes about Arnold films come from, that it's nothing but action and one-liners. Commando is the movie Last Action Hero is making fun of. Commando is the movie, aside from Lethal Weapon, that McBain is based on.
Like, oh, yeah, there, yeah.
So much of this movie, actually, I intentionally and then unintentionally, the unintentionally ones are the most fun. Anytime they said his goddamn ridiculous name, John Matrix. Matrix. Yeah, was that Polish? Like, what the... whose fucking last name is... Anyway, I'd be really curious to find out how they came to decide like okay, what's his last name? It has to sound cool. It has to sound like actiony. We'll call him Matrix. Why? This is 1985. It's not exactly a common word outside of like spreadsheets. And by spreadsheets, I mean physical fucking tables on paper. You goddamn math nerds.
I think I have an explanation for the name, and I'm
I am
employing Simpsons logic here.
No. All right.
So, okay. Remember there was that one episode of The Simpsons where Homer is trying, like, coming up with, like, a new name for himself or a fake name or something, and...
Max Power!
Yeah, exactly. He just sees the switch, and he sees Max Power, and he's like, yeah, I'm Max Power. So, imagine, like they're in the writer's room for Commando, and they're like, okay, what are we going to call this character? And it's like, Jeff Loeb and everybody else, and first of all, oh my god, Jeff Loeb wrote this?
Yeah, what?
And
we'll come back to that.
Yeah, like, they're all looking around, trying to think of a name for their character, and one of them looks over in the corner, where there's a dot matrix printer. And they're like, Matrix! Yes!
Like, I'm entertained by that. I want that to be true, so that when it comes back around inevitably to reboot season 3, and you get the fact that, like, yes, Enzo's last name has been Matrix for 3 seasons, but when you bulk him up, give him an automatic weapon, and he goes by the name Matrix, it's an obvious fucking reference. And it's like, okay. I was looking at some trivia for this and trying to determine, like, where did this come from? Is like pure Reaganism. This film and Rambo Part 2, I think, came out within like a couple of months of each other.
Yeah.
And they define the era. This is how America saw itself and its action heroes in the 80s. Everything else is adding detail and complications. Yes, anything else is adding complication above and beyond this. This and Rambo 2 are all you need to know to understand, like, American defense spending in the 80s. But I came across a reference that said, oh, originally Matrix was going to be an Israeli commando who had turned pacifist. And my brain connected to the fact that Don't Mess with the Zohan is technically based on a true story. And I suddenly started trying to find desperately, I don't think it's true, but desperately trying to find a way in which this movie and Zohan are based on the same basic story someone heard about, like, an Israeli Mossad commando in the 70s who quit and went to America. Much in the same way that singer-actor Frank Sinatra used to do movies, and he did a film called The Detective. And the main character in The Detective that he played is Detective John McClane. And it's literally a prequel to Die Hard.
Yeah.
And it's like, those are technically the same character. I wonder, I hope, I pray that deep down, John Matrix and Zohan are like the same character if you go down to their essence. It's like, yeah, it's all based on the same person. And so this is like what happens when you take it so fucking 80s seriously instead of like late 90s stupid.
Well, and I was actually just about to ask you if that was the Nick Nolte version of this.
Oh my god, that'd be even better.
Because Arnold was not, of course, not the original actor for the John Matrix character. It was originally supposed to be a Nick Nolte movie, and it was going to be darker, far more serious, an actual thought out, like, deep script.
Wow. Like, and, I'm almost impressed with their rewrite because there's no hint of that. And that takes a lot of work to strip out.
Like, what we ended up finally getting has so many guns in it that you'd swear that when the Nick Nolte, it almost sounds like it was going to be like film noir. When that version didn't pan out, it wasn't just that they decided to throw the script out. They took it to a target range and destroyed it with automatic weapons.
Yeah, they hit it with that 4-missile square rocket launcher every goddamn time. Just fire in the hole, and one goes back behind him. It's like, ah, fuck. This movie is, if it wasn't for the fact that G.I. Joe was already a thing, I would say that this inspired G.I. Joe. So much about it. I'm pretty sure Major Blood is definitely based on Bennett. There's a lot of aspects where it's just, you put a helmet on Major Blood and that's Bennett through and through. Like, we'll get into that character because holy shit, what an amazing performance. But first of all, the very super basics of the plot, because it is a very basic super plot. Arnold is an ex-special forces of some sort soldier living with his precocious daughter, wife, who knows? We don't know where she is. She might be dead. The kid has no trauma, so who the fuck cares about the wife? And they live in a probably relatively rather expensive San Fernando Valley homestead.
Oh, no, from the way that the movie opens, I submit that Matrix built the entire cabin himself from scratch.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Now, like, there's no doubt about that. He absolutely built that entire thing from scratch, legging every tree down the hill. Individually, what wonderful architecture, by the way. Like, was Matrix's. John Matrix would have been a great name in infrastructure, let me tell you. but a helicopter, an army helicopter, comes out of nowhere, and there's a colonel aboard. There's always a fucking colonel on one of these helicopters. It doesn't matter if it's Rambo, the A-Team, MacGruber. I don't fucking care. There's a colonel.
Well, that, and let's be honest, this is basically Schwarzenegger's Rambo. So
yeah,
the colonel, like the superior officer that he's best friends with. In this case, Major General Franklin Kirby.
Major General, not a traitor. No, seriously, he's not going to betray you. No, seriously, at no point in this is he going to betray you. I know. It seems so obvious. Not a traitor.
Yeah, like that character, I think as soon as Rambo came out. Especially knowing the rivalry between Stallone and Schwarzenegger, as soon as Rambo came out, that character was going to be in this movie, no matter what.
Like, I feel there's a moment later on in this film, like, because this film ratchets action up like it was on cocaine, and hey, it was the mid-80s, who's to say?
It was the mid-80s and a Joel Silver movie.
Cocaine. It was definitely cocaine. On cocaine. There's like Joel likes it. Anyway. Jesus fucking Christ. Yeah, no doubt that Arnold is like, then I will do the Rambo movie, but better. Fuck you.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a moment where it's like, okay, Rambo has a Bowie knife. Sure. Does his Bowie knife fire? Can he point it at someone and it suddenly flings itself into their face? No? Fuck you, John Rambo. Like, silly. It gets silly.
Not only would Schwarzenegger have been like, no, I'm going to do this better. I'm going to do a more wholesome Rambo.
Hey, you have like emotional issues and PTSD. I'm fucking I am the perfect father. I have no PTSD, no trauma, no hesitation. I know exactly what to do that is right at all times, regardless of what I am doing. I love that. Yeah, like his daughter seems to almost be used to this sort of thing. Like, she, you know, she's like, no, don't go. But there's no, like, real emotional depth to it. It's just, I have to cook for myself again next week. God damn it. Or, like, even better, one level better. It's like, no, if you go 3 days from now, a bunch of, like, fucking, I don't know, mobsters, paramilitary, Yakuza, who the hell knows which, will show up at the door and kidnap me, and I'll have to spend 8 hours in the back of a goddamn Cadillac trunk, and then I'll have to be tied up in a sweltering goddamn jungle room, and then we'll have to traipse through the fucking mud to a helicopter, and it's just, can we not this week?
And but my favorite thing there was how, like, the opening titles for Commando... And yeah. this is the single, simplest, yet most glorious fan edit you could ever do with a movie.
Uh-huh.
Take the theme music, the audio from the opening of any sitcom. And I literally mean any sitcom. Put it on top of the opening titles for Commando. I don't give a shit what the audio is. It will work.
Yeah, no, it will work. There's too much, like, it's very front loaded that, like, this is he's a father. He takes care of his daughter. They have a good relationship. That those are the only things you need to know, so that when his daughter is kidnapped, it's like, no, he's honestly just trying to get her back. There's no, like, overarching other emotional things of, like, oh, he let her down so many times and he has to, or she's traumatized because of the loss of her mother, or no, there's none of that. There is only, I will get my daughter back. And that's it. That's the movie. The most complex thing that occurs in this is that the bad guys technically betray him for a previous job.
Yeah.
And that's all well and cool and all. In my head, and this is just my preferred reading of it, this movie takes place after Predator. The kid's mom is the woman from that, and she, like, left or something.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So, like, that's what she means by, like, don't go again. He has to go fight a Predator, and it's like, no. It's just some geopolitical shit. Don't worry about it. So he handles it. But this is the same character. Anyway, I know that doesn't work canonically, but I'm entertained by the fact that, like, there is a version of this film, or at least there's a prequel of this film where John Matrix and his team overthrows what I presume was a democratically elected government. Like, the bad guy in this, if we're looking at actual American history, the bad guy Generalissimo in this was probably a socialist who was democratically elected. And then the CIA sent John Matrix in to install the pro-fascist fucking regime that is actually in power now. And all the bad guys in this film are actually, like, No, seriously, we're just trying to return ownership of the fields to the farmers after it was stolen by, like, United Fruit.
I mean, if I remember right, it's actually the other way around, but frankly, your version
I know, because so much better. Because are you telling me in the middle of the 80s the Reagan administration supported workers? Fuck you, you're lying.
Oh, no, if anybody's lying, it's this movie, because that's exactly what the movie would have been saying. And propaganda as hell.
Like, I'm almost surprised that at the very end they didn't, like, take a flyby fucking Russia and just slap Gorbachev in the face.
Well, I mean, considering how the opening line of that end song is, "I will protect you," that could have happened.
Yeah, this movie has a lot going on audibly. First of all, I don't just mean music. I mean, like, sound effects. It has the interesting decision to make AK-47s sound like sniper rifles,
yeah,
and a Magnum sound like God himself. Ba-doom! But more importantly, it has two very important songs. It has more songs in it, but it has two very important songs. The first is the most 80s-tastic, paternally wholesome, I don't know, hair metal song at the very end. Well, we'll talk about the hair metal because that's the least ridiculous. It's out of fucking... You have just seen, yeah, an hour and a half flat of solid slaughter. And it ends with a song that is more or less like, "Everything is awesome now. We're gonna go get some ice cream."
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like, we've talked on past episodes about movies where they have that end credit track that makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. I think it's called We Fight for Love, which this is the pinnacle of songs picked by throwing darts at a list of tracks in your music library.
I kind of like the it's ends justifies the means apologism after the fact of,
yeah,
like, why did you murder all these people? Oh, I did it for love. Yeah, no, like, obviously, if you're listening to this episode, you will hear it because I'm gonna put that fucking bitch right at the end of this movie. right at the end of this episode. But there's a more important song. And when you talked about cocaine earlier, yes. say, person listening to this, have you ever considered what happens when you take hot 80s saxophone and combine it with, the only way I can explain it is, passive aggressive steel drum, and then throw in the rest of a bad 80s soundtrack? Like just pile it all in there, then layer on your steel drum with a great fat fucking helping of hot sax. And that is the opening song and primary theme of this movie. It, Howard Shore, what the fuck?
I know, yeah. I was just gonna say, like, the out of 90-95% of the score of this movie. Now you know how, like, most action films, there'd be like this sweet guitar riff that would back pretty much every action sequence in the movie.
Oh yeah.
Switch out that guitar for steel drum for some reason.
Yeah, yeah. And if you really want to change it up, the hot sax comes in and you're just like, what the sweet Jesus fuck is happening in this film? And it works perfectly because,
yeah,
I think it's intentionally, like, it's like dazzle camouflage where you don't know what to look at. And so you're just like, and then next thing you know, you catch a shell in the face.
Yeah, I mean, like, the sax, I understood the saxophone. I mean, this is the, yeah, mid-80s.
It's the 80s.
Yeah,
sure,
so,
yeah,
like, saxophone, synth, maybe a little guitar for shits and giggles.
And
all of that, but...
Yeah, all that's good. All that's normal, cacophonous, yes, but...
The steel drum in a film that is set nowhere near Jamaica.
Ah, oh, just delightful. Delightful. It's like listening to fucking Graceland in terms,
yeah,
of, like, where the fuck is Paul Simon gonna go this time? Oh, it's a slide whistle? Cool. Yeah, it's fucking ballsy. It's out there. I kind of want Howard Shore, almost as a dare, take one song from the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Like, I don't care which song. Take one song and add in steel drum and hot sax. Mary or Pippin, whichever one, singing in front of Denethor as he eats his tomatoes. And there's another guy behind him, like, on a fucking steel drum.
Oh, my God. Oh, you're right. That'd be amazing.
That it completely destroys the emotional context of this. Shut up, boy. More steel drum and tomatoes. He's gone mad.
And unless it's a sequence with dwarves, because like with the steel, there's a connection of some sort. God knows more than any connection in Commando, but
no, that's actually the sound of the White Tree of Gondor. It sounds faintly of steel drum.
Oh my god.
Arnold Schwarzenegger's great in this because, of course, like all he's doing is action shots and unreasonable and barely believable paternalism.
Yeah.
And one-liners. Anything else he has to say that isn't a one-liner is exclusively to forward the plot as quickly as possible by, like, giving the basic amount of exposition. I don't want to do that. Bennett, you fucking betrayed me. That's it. That is the totality of his character. And as said before, it's perfect.
There is one line that you forgot in the list there. Any time Ray Don Chong asks him to explain anything.
No. Yeah, he'll tell the entire fucking plot to anyone else, but the second she asks for shit, he's like, no. Kind of racist. No. And yet she's there at the end of it, and it's kind of implied that they get together. And it's like, would you like to have a daughter? She's yours now.
Okay, well, with that implication of them getting together, apparently there was a love scene between the two of them that was filmed.
Not surprised.
But it was dropped because it didn't quite work. And I'm looking back at this movie with that knowledge, and I'm going, where would you put it?
Yeah, like, that's how much it doesn't work, because, like, if it's before she tries to get him arrested, it implies a bunch of stuff about the sex that's really nasty. If it's after, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Like, why, you know, like, if it's after they make their escape on the plane, okay, but show us what happened on the plane that made them, like, connect emotionally or at least sexually. There's a lot of, like, I'm happy that's not in there because it would feel like hitting a checklist.
Oh, yeah.
And though this film is very checklist in its nature as pretty much a template for an 80s action film, I'm happy that it doesn't hit everything because that would grind it to a halt and make it feel unrealistic. I love how quick this movie is. The vast majority of the film takes place during a flight. A flight from, like, L.A. to wherever the fuck Central American country it's supposed to be in.
It's the country of Valverde, which was the fictional country of choice for pretty much every 80s action movie.
Delightful. And yeah, it was a whole thing. Check out Granada, kids. It technically was a war. Anyway. The 80s were interesting. You get your generic South Central American dictatorship style kind of army thing that they have to fight. But very specifically, to be like for the lack of detail on so much of this, we get incredible characters who, in their void of, like, details, amazing actors are able to do amazing things. Like, there are some great actors in this. Just on the very lowest level in terms of, like, least amount of screen time, Bill Paxton is in this film. And he's memorable as just kind of like, he's a radar operator or whatever. And it's unmissably Bill Paxton. There's something Paxton about it. It's just like, this film has been blessed. It's got Paxton in a moment. Just like every other great 80s film aside from Predator, it has Paxton in it for a moment.
And somehow this is an Arnold movie with Bill Paxton where Arnold does not kill Bill Paxton.
Yes, yes. Very rare. Yeah. Very rare. Paxton survives. Paxton, I presume, goes on to have a very good career with whatever branch of the military he's in. But aside from that, please tell me who the fuck else is in this incredible cast, because it is beautiful.
Like we've said, of course, we have Arnold Schwarzenegger as our lead, Ray Don Chong as the female lead / love interest, or at least she's supposed to be, but they could never decide.
Yeah, like she's the love interest in the same way that Jock from Raiders of the Lost Ark is Indy's love interest.
Yeah,
she flies the plane.
Yeah.
That's it.
We have Dan Hedaya as our villain / 80s racist stereotype.
Oh my god, Dan.
Oh, yeah.
What? Please take the makeup off, Dan. Like, he plays a pretty decent, like, snarling villain, but you're so distracted looking at the brown face, you're just like, what the fuck?
Oh, yeah, no, like, Dan Hedaya's villain in this movie is a great character test for your entire social circle. you invite everybody over to your house. You get them all to sit down and watch Commando. Anyone who does not go, oh no, Dan, no. The second Dan Hedaya comes on screen, get those people out of your life immediately.
Dan, what are you doing? Oh my god, I know it was the 80s, but what are you doing? Great performance, though. Like, as essentially a one note, one level bad guy, it's hard to find someone else better than Dan.
Yeah, like, on the one hand, the accent is terrible.
Terrible!
On the other hand, he's clearly having a lot of mustache-twirling fun with the role.
Yeah.
And speaking of clearly having the time of his life with the role, we have Vernon Wells, who was hired for the role of Bennett, fired from the role of Bennett. No, hired for auditioned for Bennett, lost out to Bennett to Cole Hauser, who was fired from the movie. And then Vernon Wells came back in to play Bennett. And oh, we are so glad he did.
This is Vernon. Like, as much as this film has Schwarzenegger plastered all over it, honestly, it only works because Vernon Wells matches his physical intensity with, like, performance intensity. His character, Bennett, is fucking insane on so many wonderful levels. I really like one thing Vernon Wells said about him, and I always really impressed with Vernon Wells for playing gay villains at a time when that would have been like oh, gay, ew, even if it's the villain. Like, his character in Mad Max Fury Road, or Mad Max 2 The Road Warrior, is well, he's got a fucking sex slave. You know, like, it's this interesting extra level he always brings emotionally to these characters that makes them just a little more, like, entertaining to watch. And he said of Bennett, Bennett hates Matrix, but he loves him more than he hates him. And he hates that he loves him.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, that is perfect. Oh, no wonder yeah. Every time they're on screen together, it has this weird sexual energy.
Oh, my God. Oh, that's so true. And then you add into the fact that Wells described Bennett as Freddie Mercury on steroids.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, yeah. And now, you also talked about how he essentially matches Arnold's physical presence.
But, to be clear, I'm not saying he matches it himself with physical presence. He matches it with, like, performance energy.
Oh, yeah.
He's a bit on the pudgy side.
But also along with that, I think there's also the simple fact that all of Bennett's costumes were sized for Cole Hauser.
So dear God.
They were all too small for Vernon Wells.
You know, that explains a lot, because, like,
yeah.
He's wearing chainmail, and it, like, there's something very strange. I've never seen, like, a halter top chainmail before.
Oh, it's so beautifully ridiculous, and just invites, ironically enough, so many Mad Max jokes.
Yes. Ah, it's so good. And I love small, stupid things in this film. Like, they're both American Special Forces. One's Australian, one's Austrian. Don't fucking ask questions about it. Shut the fuck up. just enjoy two very hilarious actors.
No. Matrix is not Austrian. He's East
German.
Oh, yeah,
East German. You know, they didn't have the rock music in the East Germany.
Thank you, because I wanted to bring up that specific line, because, like, when Matrix is looking at a magazine and goes, why didn't they just call him Girl George? And I'm sitting there like, even the dad jokes are homophobic.
But in a really entertaining way, yeah. In which I can completely see Arnold Schwarzenegger saying that. And he doesn't mean it necessarily homophobically. He thinks it's really clever observation.
Yeah.
It's just, it was so authentic. It felt like a real comment that an 80s Reagan man would say to his daughter. Not trying to pick a fight, but just making a general comment on American culture. Well, British culture, technically, but, you know, a Western culture at the time. It is a moment of, like, 80s zeitgeist just packed in there. Arnold Schwarzenegger making a relatively benign homophobic comment about Boy George. Yep.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, it's beautifully of its time.
Yeah.
To go back to my earlier comment, if no one in your group of friends winces at that joke, ask questions. Yeah. Ask questions.
Or, yeah. There's definitely a couple of, yeah, there's moments in this where you're like, oh, this is aged weirdly.
Yeah.
And by that, I don't mean, like, you cringe the normal way one does. Like, okay, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. There's a moment in it. When they both hug each other and then call each other in revulsion the F word for gays. I'm not going to say it just because that shit tends to demonetize and you know. Anyway,
yeah.
They didn't continue that attitude in the second movie, and the writers and the actors have since been like, that was a mistake. And it stands out as being so weird, and it gets weirder and weirder over time. Because it's not in line with their characters. It's only in line with, like, presumptions of society at that time. And I'm surprised they haven't edited it out, quite frankly. But whereas that moment is so cringe, it makes your watching stop and you kind of reconsider what you're doing. It fits into the tapestry of Commando.
Yeah.
As a Reagan era fucking wet dream that it's just like, yeah, it's part of the color of it. There's something, no matter how horrible this film gets with like 80s presumptions, phobias, bigotries, and shit like that, it feels historically and contextually in place. It doesn't feel abrupt. It's like, yes, and that's exactly what the 1980s were like. This movie came out almost exactly in the middle of the 80s. This movie actually came out 7 days before I was born. and it perfectly encapsulates. Technically, this movie came out, yeah, the same, within the same week that Back to the Future, the Back to the Future trilogy occurs. So this is occurring, and somewhere else in California is Back to the Future 1-3. Headcanon. So yeah, you have to kind of take it as like, as almost representing a zeitgeist of the era. It's not aggressively offensive. It's not trying to offend anyone, and it's not trying to be like, well, we could do this because we're tough guys and you just can't take it. It's just doing it because it's part of the presumption of the era. And it's so just like naturally slid in as part of its mosaic that it's, yes, you will cringe. Yes, you will have a reaction, but it doesn't stand out the same way. Yeah. This entire film is everything wrong and right in terms of its personal perception of itself, like the era's perception of itself, of Reagan 80s. All of it. Just crammed into a really efficient hour and a half.
Now, to keep going with the cast list, that, yeah, you remember when we were doing that?
Listen.
That's the beautiful thing in this movie. That's the beautiful thing in this movie. You just say an actor's name, you can go so many places.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. They really do. Come out to play.
I'm about to get to him. before I get to him is James Olsen as the aforementioned Major General Franklin Kirby, who arrives by helicopter after Matrix pretty much smells the helicopter coming. And before you complain about that moment, dear listener, I would like to point out I have seen enough Airwolf to know that that was 1,000% a thing in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but, yeah.
Kirby's arrival is one of the most beautiful things in this movie, because number one, apparently every character who's associated with Matrix in a positive way is introduced by one of them sneaking up onto the other one.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, it's Matrix sneaking up on Kirby while he's like looking for him, and Kirby turns him, is like, he says something to the effect of, "I see he's as quiet and stealthy as ever." This is the only point in the entire movie where Matrix does anything that is not loud, destructive, and done for the sole purpose of drawing attention to himself.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I once read that Metal Gear, and its specific like approach to video game play was based on Commando initially, and so it was supposed to be that, like, more of a shooting game, but it didn't, the literal like gameplay tech of it didn't work out that way, and so it turned into a sneaking game, and it's just, it's so fucking funny, because yeah, it he literally will like walk out in the open carrying a shit ton of weapons and people will start firing at him and he just turns and blah, 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 blah. There's no cover. There's no sneaking up. There's no like trying to like sneakily kill someone. I think the sneakiest kill in this is he literally leans over like around a corner and goes, "Hey," and then shoots the guy with the fucking knife. He alerts him so that he can get the best kill he can have.
Yeah. And after Olsen comes the just aforementioned David Patrick Kelly, whose Sully is... He's in the movie just to be slimy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, like, that's why you get David Patrick Kelly. He does slimy really well. And dang, this guy is slimy and like creepy and shit. And he's possibly the most intricate character in the movie, which is really saying something.
Yeah, he's basically that ratty type character where you would immediately picture Steve Buscemi.
Yeah, yeah. And mixed with, like, Steve Buscemi, I always think has, like, almost a heart of gold. Like, even when he's when he's playing a cannibal, you still get the sense that he has the heart of gold. Specifically, yeah. Like, you know, in Con Air, where he's having tea with the little girl. This guy has the special, like, in the other realm, he has the potential of, like, every character he play has no heart. Completely soulless scum fuck. This is the guy who you completely believe. And again, this is a testament to Kelly's acting, not him as a person. Be very fucking clear.
Oh yeah.
He plays these kind of characters so well that when he hits on incessantly and harasses a woman and she tells him to fuck off and he turns to her and goes, "Whore," it's like, yes, I can believe that your character is that fucking douchebag. Because that hasn't changed. You can find a dime a dozen pricks like that.
Yeah. No, I was literally just about to say that whenever you hear a woman describing a negative, potentially threatening encounter with a man.
Yeah.
It's Sully every time.
You can just picture him being like, "Hey. Yeah."
But
there with the fucking three bottles.
but also with Sully and the famous exchange of, "Sully, you know when I said I was going to kill you last?" Now, of course, in this scene, Schwarzenegger is holding Sully over a cliff by his ankle. Now, if you want to understand how truly 80s ball to the wall in cocaine fueled insane that this movie was. Film director Mark Lester, apparently, honest to God, told Schwarzenegger to actually hold David Patrick Kelly over the cliff by his leg. And Schwarzenegger was the one to go, "Are you insane?"
"I'm not doing that." That is great. I love that it took Schwarzenegger to be like, "Have some fucking decorum. This is, be professional." Jesus.
Oh, forget decorum. This is just straight up common sense, because if Schwarzenegger's arm gets tired, and he's only holding him by one arm.
Yeah, no, that's true.
If that arm gets tired, David Patrick Kelly is dead.
Dead. But yeah, like, he arguably David Patrick Kelly's character gets told the best one-liner from it. It's a great, actually, technically it's not a one-liner because it has setup. But it's quintessential, you know, like, remember when I said I'd kill you last? Yeah, you did. I love the hope in his voice. Yeah, you did. Yeah, so you have to wait until you've killed everyone else. Yeah, okay, cool. And then I lied and just drops him. And it's like, it's so that's the perfect, that's where the McBain comes from. Yes. That's the McBain right there.
Oh, 1,000%.
But like, yeah, who gets a better death, him or Bennett, with let off some steam after he impales him with a metal fucking pipe into a water, hot water pressure thinger, whatever.
Yeah.
It's so over the top, and it's only made better by the fact that, one, that fight begins with Bennett yelling, "I'm gonna kill you now, okay?" While like holding his Bowie knife and like staring right at it, like he's about to like he's fucking honoring the god of the Bowie knife with this sacrifice or some shit. Great levels of crazy. But there's a fake death when Bennett gets thrown into a generator, and you're like, oh, okay, he's gonna electrocute to death. They stand there for like a good 5 seconds, and they just leaves it. Like he was there by choice. He just needed a little bit of a pick me up. I am so pissed that that Vernon Wells never did professional wrestling.
Oh my god.
Yeah, you get him and like Randy Savage like working in a ring against each other. It's just yes. Go. Yes. Go.
Oh, he would have been so perfect for the 80s WWF. Oh my god.
He would have been incredible. Incredible. It's speaking of like great talents that are kind of wasted in this, Bill Duke is set up to be the bad guy for like the prologue and then quickly gets off. It's like he's killing so many other people himself, and you're like, oh yes, Bill Duke's gonna be a badass take no shit villain. No. Oh, but Bill Duke. I'm not complaining because, you know, Bennett's still a great villain.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
But I demand the version of this where Bill Duke is the bad guy throughout.
I would also absolutely love to see that version, but for a very different, utterly trivial reason, which is, I don't know if you caught this, but Every time we see Bill Duke's character with a car, it's a Cadillac. It's a Cadillac, but it's a different Cadillac every time.
Yeah, I like the idea that like that middle kill, that's unrelated. This is just how he gets cars.
I just want to see how many different Cadillacs he could end up with for how many different reasons.
He's the Cadillac salesman killer. I mean, like, I do wet work for the CIA, yeah, but I prefer, my passion is killing Cadillac salesmen.
Oh yeah, you know, like he's like the one actor where I refuse to learn his character's name because I'm just like, no, you're the Cadillac man. I don't care what they actually call you. You are the Cadillac man.
I love his enormous remote that he pulls out to blow up the boat. And the thing's like the fucking size of his head.
Oh, 80s technology.
They didn't even like try to make it something else. You know, like they could have been like, oh yeah, it's military tech, so it's like smaller. No. Nah. That thing is like, that thing's fucking enormous. It's like holding a personal pizza box and just being like, I'm discreet. I'm so discreet.
But of course, finally playing Matrix's daughter is a very young, and I mean, just after wrapping season one of Who's the Boss, very young Alyssa Milano.
Yeah, who, so kid characters in movies, of course, are, you get one or the other, really fucking annoying, or yep, good, you were there, you did what your character needed to do to get the plot forward, and you had chemistry with the main character enough that when you're on screen together, I'm not throwing up. It worked.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
No, she worked well. I love the fact that after she's kidnapped and locked in a random empty room, she engineers her own escape.
Yeah, I mean, you'd expect the child of John Matrix to at least have some sort of home alone skills. And if it's just escaping, cool, good. You did the very least you had to, and it was good for the plot because it kind of like exits her out of danger, which allows you to more so enjoy the needless rampant slaughter.
There's also the simple fact that if she waits for her dad, she's dead.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. Like, yeah. It also makes good sense of, like, even though he's amazing and he's making great time, oh my God, you know, you still gotta at least put in a little bit of effort. And I like that that ties back to the montage at the beginning, because a couple of moments in the montage, he's clearly, like, training her to kind of, like, be able to defend herself a little
bit. Yeah, yeah.
And so it's a tiny moment, but it reinforces that he's not a worthless parent. He actually cares for this kid and has taught her things that are apparently necessary and important in her life. Because once again, I guess she just gets kidnapped sometimes. She's like Johnny Quest. This happens once a week. Don't worry about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, You could almost make the case of this being the blueprint for the Taken franchise. Except I'm looking at Liam Neeson's character there and I'm going, I think Schwarzenegger might be the better parent.
Schwarzenegger is definitely the better parent.
Yeah.
Because, like, she doesn't get kidnapped because she is, like, pretentious and snooty and up her own butt and decides to ignore her father. No, we're not even going that far enough. She's a child who gets grabbed by a bunch of paramilitary assholes. It has nothing to do with bad parenting whatsoever. This movie goes out of its way to really excuse, like, no, he's a good parent. It's not his fault. So don't think of it that way. It does everything it needs to do to have you not thinking about other aspects of this film. Like, it doesn't want you to deconstruct. It doesn't want you to analyze. It wants you to sit there and laugh at the ridiculous, over-the-top violence of it all. That's the point of the movie. If you laughed when Schwarzenegger threw two Bowie knives at guys and they both, you know, like, one went in one dude's face and the other in, like, his chest, good! That was the point of it. Yeah, it was over the top and ridiculous. That is the point. And it's nice that this movie finds the proper middle ground where it's just on the verge of Weird Al in UHF and then later the Weird Al biography where it's silly. It's over the top. It is over the top. It is silly. But it rides that line so perfectly that never becomes parody of itself, but at the same time is almost beyond parody.
I mean, this is a movie where we see Schwarzenegger essentially break out of a 747 as it's taking off.
Calmly as well. He's just like, excuse me. He just fucking, like, leaves the cabin, breaks into the secure area, breaks out of the strut, hanging on the side, like hanging on to the wheel, and just like, okay, yeah, in 10 seconds, 9 seconds, 8 seconds, throws himself perfectly into a swamp. It's like, how many times have you done this before, John?
Yeah, yeah. And like, it's just a simple fact. He lands in a puddle.
Yeah.
A puddle. and then beats up an entire mall just to get to Sully. Now, I'm not talking about the security guards. He beats up the actual mall.
Yeah, he beats up the mall. He beats up the guards. He beats up some people in the way. He beats up the concept of American 80s mall consumerism. This movie has a lot to say and says nothing. Intentionally. Like, all of this could mean so much. All of it could mean so much. It means nothing.
No, it doesn't. And as much as in this, like, the second act of this movie, there is so much that we could play with. For the sake of time, we're going to go straight to the final act. And that the final action sequence that, if you love silly 80s action films, just the final 20 minutes or so of Commando, like, you could take out those first two acts entirely and just watch Schwarzenegger land at that, what I'm pretty sure was in reality an abandoned military base. But if you want to discover the godlike powers that John Matrix clearly must have,
there's a way to cut all of that action so that it, like, it repeats, but, like, out of sequence, and you could probably have that run for a solid 5 hours. Just take every individual moment of it and like, so here's the first run, then here's it backwards, then here's it every scene is spliced and flipped, here is it, and like, and it's just do it that way, like, literally reverse the image. You could have that run for at least a solid hour before people, like, got bored watching it.
I mean, like, and also if you enjoy watching 80s action scenes just for the errors or for those moments. Again, just, this is just the pinnacle. Like, you have now, or early on in the movie, you do have the famous Schwarzenegger careening down a hill in a truck, where you can clearly see from the footage that they actually used, that man should have died at least 4 times.
Oh yeah.
But that final action sequence where you have, okay, yes, we did see him planting a few Claymore mines. Claymore mines don't do that. You have explosions where that man did not plant anything. You have Schwarzenegger standing wide out in the open, just spraying bullets, not aiming anything. You have enemy soldiers who died without getting hit by a bullet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, like, listen, at that point, if I see a guy, like, double-fisting fucking M16s or AK-47s or something, I'm just going to be like, oh, you got me.
Saw blades that are tossed like frisbees. And then, of course, we came to Bennett and the famous slit off some steam where, I'm sorry, with everything that you have witnessed beforehand, Bennett is the only possible way that you can wrap that up.
Yeah, it has to be over the top. It has to have the worst line in the entire film. Like, it is the cheesiest, most forced, most obvious, most cringe, most eye-rolling one-liner of his entire career. And it's just perfect because of Bennett.
Yeah. Like,
if you had done that to a serious character, it wouldn't have worked. If you had said that to Bill Duke, it wouldn't have worked. But it's just that it's silly to silly. It's contrasting sillies, and it just works so brilliantly. And then the movie ends with, like, the military show up, and they're like, "Wow, that was fucking crazy. Hey, can you kill some people for us? No? Oh, okay. I guess I'll just be sad." This is a fucking international incident.
Oh, no, it's not. Because that island is literally just, like, off the coast of Los Angeles.
Oh, I know, but like not only that, it's one of those really fun ones where it's like I wanted a news report talking about it afterwards, because it's like he's a hero to this nation, like whatever nation it is. You mentioned the name earlier. Anyway, Valverde. The current government that holds power was put in place by John Matrix, and he's apparently a national hero. And so it is an international incident in the fact that like this whole thing stems from the blowback of American wet work. But at the same time, it would be so fucking weird, because it's like we're throwing John Matrix a parade. Why? Oh, apparently there was almost a coup. John took care of it.
Oh, yeah, I mean, imagine if the final sequence actually took place in Valverde, and everything wraps up. You go to credits, and as the credits are playing, it's like news footage from like in Valverde, and that same song is playing over top of it.
They're just talking about like casualty rates and shit. How much money the destruction cost this already poor island?
Yeah, yeah.
Or like even worse, just be like the pro John Matrix regime then went on to implement like a system of genocide or some shit. Valverde was purged this morning.
Oh my god. Yeah, like if you're a child of the 80s, this is essentially your introduction to Michael Bay movies.
Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah. This movie, like I said before, this is the prototype, the stereotype, the cliche, the foundation. This movie is the action film of the 80s. It canonically wasn't the first. It canonically wasn't the last. It came out right in the middle. But if you want to know what 80s action films, every 80s action film was about, you just need to watch Commando. You just need to. What is Predator if not Commando with an alien?
Exactly. Yeah,
what
exactly.
Is Rambo if not Commando with actual character death?
I mean, as I said last week, Commando is every more famous Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, but you've stripped away everything but Schwarzenegger.
Yeah. It's a thing of beauty in its simplicity.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that it's not the most famous Schwarzenegger movie, but it's by a wide margin the most influential.
Yeah, it's not the most famous Schwarzenegger movie, but whether you mean to or not, it is the one you're thinking of when you think about Schwarzenegger. It's the one that set the tone for everything that came after. Because like if you think about it, Terminator is not a Schwarzenegger film in that sense, the first Terminator, because he doesn't actually have any one-liners in it. He's a cold, methodical, emotionless machine. When he says I'll be back, he's not having a line. He's literally informing a character, which is a juxtapositional joke of like, of course the machine would be like, I will return. And then by return, I mean, I'm going to drive a fucking Oldsmobile into you. It's a setup for a joke, but it's not a one-liner. He's not playing like the Terminator in the Terminator, as Arnold Schwarzenegger plays it, is not the Terminator of T2. T2 is John Matrix a robot.
You know, which...
John Matrix is every character since that Schwarzenegger has ever played.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you to also make that Terminator connection is the simple fact that "I'll be back" was worked into pretty much every Schwarzenegger film since the first Terminator.
Yeah, exactly. And like, you almost get the feeling, like, I know it immediately became a classic and it got attached to him in such immediately because it's a great moment and it sticks with you. But you almost feel that when they say it in this, it's like you wrote that before the movie, didn't you? Because it's not a wink and nod. It's not a wink and nod moment. It's organic to what is happening with the character. And I almost feel like that was the accidental sequential "I'll be back." And from there, everyone picks it up and repeats it.
I could totally see that. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's Undertaker winning his first 10 rounds and no one noticing. And then being like, wait a minute, that's a streak.
Hey, we could play with that.
So yeah, there's no way to say just how like influential this film is. You have to see it and recognize in yourself the many aspects that you take for granted from this film.
And also, quite simply, even if you don't recognize those things, make no mistake, you're going to have a damn good time.
Oh, yeah. 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 No, you're going to have fun. This movie is dumb fun, and it means to be. That's what matters most. It achieves its goal because its goal is very simple.
Oh, yeah. Even if the only thing that you have learned from this movie is that if you need to get a bunch of guns, all you have to do is rip the front of a surplus city off and just walk in and take whatever you need.
Yeah, if the cops show up, don't worry. You can just be like, it's fine. Well, that was a lot of fun. What could we possibly be watching next that could meet this level of ridiculousness?
My original plan was for something that was going to be just as comedic and ridiculous, but probably more painful. But then I had a thought, made a little last minute change. But we are going to stick with personal firsts and 80s action heroes, because Jean-Claude Van Damme is essentially known for two things: Bloodsport and trying to remake Bloodsport.
Wow, that's not where my mind goes for Jean-Claude Van Damme. Yes. That's really interesting. It's just the different point. In my mind, Jean-Claude Van Damme is known for two things: Universal Soldier and kicking Bison's ass.
I mean, also valid. But I use that joke because our next movie will be the first film that I went to the theater to see by myself. Which was one of those Bloodsport remakes, a lesser known film called The Quest.
I think I remember the VHS copy cover of that.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, if you have heard of this film at all, it's probably because you just happened to see the cover of the movie when you were walking past the $5 bin at Walmart, and it's just like in the corner of your eye, and you noticed it and forgot it like 30 seconds later.
Yeah. Well, that's going to be fun, because I can't think of it like beyond that what I suspect is the cover, and it may not even be. Who the fuck knows? So, yeah. Join us next week when we look at Jean-Claude Van Damme's The Quest. It's going to be Belgian-tastic. Until then, if you want to get in touch with us, if you want to threaten us with revenge, I will have my revenge on Matrix. You can contact us at...
If you need to radio Major General Kirby with the message commando, which... like 35 years later, I still have no idea what that's a code for. We can be reached by email at realgeekshfx@gmail.com, via Twitter at realgeekshfx. You can find me at the Maritime Lord on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, Hive, which I should probably check at least once.
Make sure it's still existing.
Yeah. Mm. the TikTok analog Clapper, if I ever decide to do anything with my Clapper account. But anyway.
And I can be found on Twitter at Friday in Halifax and Crash and Burn everywhere else. Gratuitous explosions.